Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Americans have been fighting on who can fully participate in our democracy since the founding of the Republic. Over time, we broadened the base by allowing black men and then women to vote, but those steps forward were usually coupled with roadblocks and restrictions. Today, the favorite tools for limiting voting seem to be gerrymandering, voter ID laws, and decreasing access to polls by reducing locations and cutting hours. On this Politics Monday, as we head into the election and with North Carolinians among the first in the nation to cast votes, we look at the intersection of race and voting rights in our state with the help of two experts who also have a bold vision for the future. James Lalutis is a history professor focusing on that of the modern South and is also Associate Dean for Honors at UNC Chapel Hill. Robert Korstad is Professor Emeritus of Public Policy at the Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy. Together, they have written Fragile Democracy: The Struggle Over Race and Voting Rights in North Carolina. It's their, I think, third book together, and they both join us for the hour. Welcome to you both. Thank you for doing this. Appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Yep. Thank you, Mike.
So let me begin with you, Jim. The title of your book, Fragile Democracy, could apply to a lot of different aspects of what's happening in the United States today, but you take a deep dive into the struggle over voting rights in one state, ours. Voting rights are certainly at the heart of democracy, and democracy is fragile, as we are coming to find out. Is it more so in North Carolina because of our history?
Yeah, I think it is more so in North Carolina. If you take the long view of this state's history, what you find is that this state, certainly since the end of the Civil War and emancipation, has, they wouldn't have called it this at the time, but has been a purple state. Where the battles over voting rights had been particularly intense. I think because if you look at elections historically, you see what you see today, and that is it takes only the tiniest numbers moved in one direction or the other to end up with, you know, profoundly different results.
Wow. Bob, you both say that America is at war with itself over the right to vote, over the question of who gets to vote. And you go back, as James just said, to 1865 to begin this struggle. And in 1865, you go into great detail in this book about the politics and the maneuvering to recover from the Civil War and integrate blacks into society and into the voting mechanism. And it's relatively understandable, although regrettable, why that was a problem back then. But it continues to this day. Why?
Well, I think there are a lot of issues at stake here, and I think there's kind of a fundamental difference between the way different groups of citizens in the state understand democracy and understand the role of government. And so at the end of the Civil War, you come out of with freedmen and women gaining freedom, they see the state as a vehicle for expanding their rights, expanding their opportunities, expanding their access to education, et cetera, et cetera. And that kind of that vision of the state is something is an instrument for doing good for everyone, for bettering all people, is one vision of the state. And on the other hand, you have, I would argue, you know, more conservative vision that believes in small government, limited taxation, a limited role for government. And to some extent, that is, you know, really at the heart of what the struggle has been. Race has been a way at which that's played itself out. But I think we're still battling about what we think democracy and is really about.
But following the Civil War, fundamentally, and we'll talk about this in greater detail later in the program, we were fundamentally what? Oligarchy is a good word to use, because the eastern part of the state, which was controlled by slave owners and farmers and the big commerce of the state at the time, they controlled the legislature. They controlled the wheels of power. Is that also what this struggle is based on, not wanting to cede power to others?
I think even that gets right to the core of it. The state had been an oligarchy before the Civil War. It sometimes surprises people to learn that there were a larger number of slaveholders on a percentage basis in North Carolina's legislature than any other in the South. And you know, these two visions of government that Bob is talking about, you know, it's everyone should go pick up a copy of the 1868 North Carolina Constitution, which has a remarkable phrase put there by former slaves. And it talks of a government, I think I'm quoting it correctly, instituted solely for the good of the whole. And so government is an instrument that lifts up and creates opportunity and provides security to us all, as opposed to, as Bob was saying, a minimalist government that works in the favor of private accumulation. And so that's a profound difference. You know, there's a historian colleague we often quote, her name is Barbara Fields, has written extensively on these sorts of issues. And Barbara, in one of her books, says, look, slave owners did not enslave Africans because they hated black people, though they certainly did. They enslaved Africans because they wanted to plant cotton and make money. And part of the argument of this book is that race has worked in a very similar way. From the time of emancipation right until our time today.
So James just illustrated one of the things you write about in the book, Bob, that our politics today is continuous with the past that made it, marked by struggles that have never really ended, only ebbed, sifted, and returned. And the struggle over who gets to vote isn't just about racism or about race, but on a political system built on race and racism that dates back centuries. When you look back, I guess it's easier to identify that racism. But today, a lot of people want to deny that racism exists or that it's playing any role whatsoever in American life or politics. Were you attempting to help us see the reality of that today by writing this book, Bob?
Yeah, I think that was one of our purposes when we wrote this book, because, particularly after the election of President Obama, people have been talking about a post-racial society. And yet what we saw in North Carolina and across the country was really a reaction to that election. And I think that, even in the way in which the Republican Party in North Carolina has governed, the way it has made its appeals, the kind of public policies it's pursued, are still a reflection of that kind of racial past. So that, whether it's who suffers from the kinds of public policies that have been pursued by the General Assembly, whether it's in terms of voting rights or whether it's in terms of social welfare policy. Low-income people, both black and white and Hispanic, have been at the kind of center of that. And so I think that the issues that we're dealing with today and the way that race is being employed both as a divisive tool but also as a targeting tool is very similar to what it's been over the last 150 years.
How much of it is based, because we've gone through this gerrymandering situation and voter ID laws here in North Carolina, both of which have been dealt with by the courts, but how much of this is racially based? They're certainly using race because they believe that one race favors one party or the other. How much of it is race? How much of it is economic? How much of it is just pure politics and not really based on racism at all?
Well, the first part of that is maybe one of the most profound chicken and egg stories or questions. we could identify. If you take the long view and go back to the history of Western Europe, I mean, conceptions of race and the kinds of economic concerns that we're talking about have always been entangled and have always moved together. So I'm not sure we can. The answer to that question is sort of yes. Both at one time. But in terms of just hardball politics, I mean, certainly there's plenty of hardball politics. But when people want to sort of describe this away, right, to sort of put it to the side and we'll say, look, this is just partisanship. Well, I mean, that doesn't work because the parties flipped so dramatically in the 20th century. In 1865, it was Democrats who called themselves conservatives. In fact, in North Carolina, that's exactly what they called themselves, not Democrats, but conservatives with a capital C. And it was Republicans who that was, the party of emancipation of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. But that political alliance flipped beginning in the 1930s.
And we will talk about that. We'll talk about the beginnings of all this, go back to 1865 and those amendments that you just mentioned, voting rights struggles, white supremacy, and more as we continue our conversation with Bob Korstadt and Jim Lelutis, both authors of Fragile Democracy, The Struggle Over Race and Voting Rights in North Carolina. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about our fragile democracy with a focus on North Carolina. Fragile Democracy is the name of a book, the subtitle of which is The Struggle Over Race and Voting Rights in North Carolina by our two guests today, James Lelutis, who's a professor of history and the dean of honors at UNC Chapel Hill, and Robert Korstadt, professor emeritus at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. So let's go back, as you do in the book, to the Civil War and the post-Civil War era, 1865. And if we are to understand where we are today, you say that's where we have to start, and specifically with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. The 13th Amendment ended slavery. The 14th granted formerly enslaved people citizenship and equal protection under the law. And the 15th forbid states to deny them the right to vote. These amendments, of course, were the spoils of war. The North decided they were going to do this and impose it on the South, and the South had to submit. Was it reasonable to expect then that those amendments would set things right and heal the nation and end our original sin? I'm not sure who to ask. Bob, go ahead.
Well, I don't know if it was something that we could have expected. Certainly there were lots of complications and lots of different opinions, not only in the South, but around the country. But I think it was this kind of second breath of freedom in the United States. And it really provided opportunities for the nation to put slavery and the politics of slavery and the divisiveness that slavery had created in the nation behind itself, and to try to move forward, to try to expand democracy for all people. I mean, I think we have to remember that lots of whites didn't participate in our government. They didn't have the right to vote. Certainly women didn't have the right to vote. So this moment after the Civil War, I think, was a real opportunity. And certainly there was going to be opposition in the South to the fact that that former slaves were voting and were being elected to office. But I think the kinds of the violence and the persistence of the reaction to emancipation and to these new constitutional amendments was somewhat unexpected, at least on the part of Northerners.
But it did work for a while. And I'm curious, I know that when it worked, there were black office holders and blacks were voting, and there was a coalition formed essentially between formerly enslaved people and some poor white folks who had been disenfranchised up until then. Until that was overturned, this cooperative effort, did it work? Did the state benefit from their cooperation?
Yeah, Mike, I mean, I'll go back and just to pick up on one thing Bob was saying and then address that directly. Okay. And, the idea that these amendments were something imposed on the South. What was extraordinary in North Carolina is that a larger percentage of whites than in any other Southern state during Reconstruction crossed the race line and joined a biracial alliance within the Republican Party. So in many respects, this was a kind of homegrown vision of democracy as well as one that, you know, was crafted in Washington. I mean, it always surprises people to know that North Carolina was the third state in the country and the first in the South to ratify the 15th Amendment. And that speaks to, you know, the power and the potential and the possibility of that biracial alliance. Now, that alliance, of course, was fraught. Black people had a lot of reason to be distrustful of whites, and whites who'd always thought of their freedom as the opposite of being black had lots of reasons to be, you know, hesitant about that alliance. But when they came together, and this happened again in the 1890s as well, you know, we usually think about Reconstruction being over in 1877 when most of the Federal troops left, but what we talk about is a long period of Reconstruction, 35 years, all the way to the disfranchisement of black voters in 1900. But in both those episodes, in terms of benefits to the state, it's really quite remarkable. Big new investments in public education, big new investments in caring for the poor, big new investments or big changes in election law. So they, you know, these folks didn't just talk the talk of democracy, but they put it to work in public policy as well.
I want to go back to this idea that this was news to me till I saw it in your book, that we were an oligarchy essentially prior to the Civil War, with the legislature really being occupied and controlled by wealthy planters, slave owners. I think they were taxed according to the number of slaves that they owned, and so with that came political power. So the East was the powerhouse, and the Piedmont and the western stretches of the state were not. There seem to be vestiges. If you live in Charlotte, there seem to be vestiges of that at work today. We are ignored and looked down upon that's our opinion, by the current legislature. Is that a vestige of that?
Yeah, to some degree it is, although that imbalance in political power is, you know, was pretty much sorted out in the 20th century. But it also helps us understand that when we look at, where were those whites who crossed the color line? They were back here in the Piedmont and in western North Carolina. Those were the people who had grievances against the powers, you know, that were in the state legislature. And also explains, and this always surprises my students, why Klan violence was most intense in the Piedmont, not down east where the, you know, black population was concentrated. The Klan was certainly active there. Again, because Klan violence was aimed at suppressing the black vote, but also at suppressing the vote of their white allies. And just one other thing, I mean, back to the difference these coalitions made, when we talk about an oligarchy before the Civil War, it's important to remember that when voters went to the polls before the Civil War, they elected two local officials, a sheriff and a clerk of court. County government was in the hands of appointed justices of the peace and was in effect hereditary. And you know, what those biracial alliances, one of the things they did was to change the law so that local government was put in the hands of democratically elected officials, something we take for granted today.
So prior to the Civil War, wealthy white guys ran the state. They were in charge here. And just prior to the Civil War, I read in your book that because they were... I'm trying to get this in my head right. They were worried that poor white people would not lift a finger to fight for their slaveholding rights during the Civil War. They made some adjustments. What did they adjust, Bob?
Well, they had done this a little bit earlier, but they'd made the franchise available to all white men in the 1830s, when there was a real concern that whites in the Piedmont, the small farmers, would no longer support the slaveocracy. Right at the beginning of the Civil War, they began to tax on a more equitable basis the property and slaves, so that there was you know, a real concern at that time that the majority of white North Carolinians were not going to support secession. And secession was a real battle in North Carolina. We were one of the last states to secede. And there was tension throughout the Civil War period, including in 1864 when, you know, there was a very contested election. And it wasn't entirely clear that the majority of voters were going to continue to support the war effort.
So following the war, because of the amendments that we mentioned, black people gained political power. They gained the right to vote. They made this alliance, this shaky alliance with poor white folks who had as much to gain as they did with the newfound political power that they had because of these amendments. But gradually, during the 1870s, economic forces, you say, would result in the Republican Party becoming more aligned with big business. The Republican Party was the party of emancipation. The two parties, as you mentioned earlier, have kind of flipped. Or began to flip back then, and they became more aligned with big business and less with aligned with poor whites and Negroes. And they saw a way to reintegrate the South into the national economy by aligning themselves with money. You say, to put it simply, profit trumped principle in what became known as America's Gilded Age. As you write about that, a lot of the things you write about sound very familiar. They sound very much like today, Jim.
Yeah, they do. as Bob was talking, I was thinking the same thing, right? We could change the dates and people might have a hard time trying to figure out whether we're talking past or present. But we have this 35-year period from 1865 to 1900 in North Carolina in which those biracial alliances, you know, formed twice. Once in the late 1860s, again during economic turmoil, the panic of 1893, which pushes, you know, middling and poor whites to make common cause with black North Carolinians once more. What results there, I think, is relatively familiar to people. The white supremacy campaigns of 1898 and 1900, including the Wilmington insurrection, the Wilmington coup. And then in 1900, the disenfranchisement by constitutional amendment of black men. And after that, the Republican Party in North Carolina, in effect, in an attempt to save itself, adopted a policy of being lily white, that is, purging itself of black members. So what disenfranchisement does is mean that we really have from 1900 until the the early 1970s, one party government in North Carolina. And the Republican Party, it sort of hung on in Western North Carolina as a remnant, you know, parts of the state that had been pro-union. But the big pivot comes starting in the 1930s in the Great Depression in the New Deal. It's when the parties begin to flip positions.
Talk a minute about the rise of sharecropping and the rise of mills. Sharecropping seemed to impact the lives of African-American North Carolinians and put them in almost a permanent cycle of poverty. Not only could they not get out, they seemed to get deeper and deeper into it because of the way sharecropping was set up. And something similar, but not exactly the same, for white folks in the western part of the state, in the mills. Talk about that for a second, how that impacted our politics and our economics and where we are today.
Yeah, so sharecropping and tenant farming was kind of developed in the South after the Civil War. Planters, as they kind of reasserted themselves, really hoped to replicate the kind of slave system without slavery. So a task of some people, you know, working for the owner of the large farms. And African-American freedmen and freedwomen really resisted that. They wanted some control and over their labor and their family's labor. And so sharecropping was, you know, a little bit of a compromise. But it also was based on, you know, an economic system and a credit system that really impoverished and made it impossible for people to get ahead. And the whole growth of a commercial agriculture and the growth of cotton production began to ensnare whites as well as blacks as they entered a market economy, which they had done only minimally before the Civil War. And in the process, you know, particularly through periods of economic depression, more and more people just couldn't survive on the farm. And that was the genesis of the labor force that comes into the textile mills that are being built in the Piedmont in Western North Carolina. Those had been here to some extent right before the Civil War. So it was a kind of a natural process in the South. We had cotton, we had waterways, and we had some limited capital, and that was the whole process of development of a textile industry.
And both of the
poor whites in.
Both of those things kept poor white people and poor black people in poverty at the benefit of wealthier individuals. When we come back, because we've talked on this program about the coup in Wilmington, which is illustrative of how the parties flipped and the desire by then Democrats to rid the state of Negro influence and these are their words, in politics, and what that meant as Jim Crow began and lasted for a good part of the 20th century. Our guests today are Jim Ludis and Robert Korstad, authors of Fragile Democracy. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. James Ludis is Professor of History and Dean of Honors, or Dean for Honors at UNC Chapel Hill. Robert Korstad is Professor Emeritus at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. And together, they have written their third book, this time about North Carolina, Fragile Democracy, the Struggle Over Race and Voting Rights in North Carolina. It's a history lesson, how we got to where we are today. And one of the things you have to pass through when you're talking about any state, anywhere in the country, pretty much, is Jim Crow. Jim Crow is generally thought of something that was imposed on black people, much to their detriment. There's no arguing that. But evidently, it also didn't help white people, particularly poor white people in the South. Jim, talk about that.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think oftentimes people think of Jim Crow as racial bias, prejudice, discrimination, and it certainly was those things. But one of the fundamental arguments of the book is that the regime of Jim Crow was a regime of power, and if you can borrow a phrase from Ta-Nehisi Coates, a regime of power and plunder. And if we think about how Jim Crow worked, it's Bob was saying it locked most black people on the land, drove their earnings down to near subsistence levels. And that, you know, in the marketplace, dragged down the value of all labor, including the labor of working class white people. And this regime of Jim Crow, you know, to get back to the racism and bias, it also, in a way, protected itself from the kinds of challenges that had occurred during Reconstruction and then at the late 19th century by urging poor working class whites not to challenge the economic order, you know, lest they lose the benefits of their white skins or what W.E.B. Du Bois called the wages of whiteness. And you could see that working in the textile industry, which for all intents and purposes excluded black people. There were some exceptions. But if you go back and look at the you know, sermons that were preached, believe it or not, and also speeches at the dedication of mills, mill owners talked about themselves as the saviors of poor white people. So, you know, this regime of Jim Crow plays a big role, and these questions we're talking about race and class, a big role in explaining why historically North Carolina has been a very poor state and why to, you know, a considerable degree it remains a poor state today.
And during Jim Crow, all kinds of roadblocks were put up so that black people couldn't vote. That was a major problem, which continues to this day, but in a different form, because even after the vestiges of Jim Crow were wiped off the map in the 1960s, there have been power struggles ever since, and they seem to erupt over voting and voting rights. We have seen in this state attempts to gerrymander in favor of one party over the other, struck down by courts. The man who drew the latest lines admitted that he drove that he drew them in a way that really gave favor to the Republican Party, and he would have made it more so, but he couldn't figure out how to do that any more than he already did it. And then the state's voter ID laws were struck down by courts because they said they targeted African Americans with surgical precision. Gerrymandering on the surface sounds just like a partisan struggle. You know, one party wants to win over the other party. Voter ID appears to be more racially based. You say that race underpins both. But is that because Democrats have more support than Republicans from African Americans, or is it due to naked race and prejudice, racism and prejudice? Bob?
Well, I think it's more instrumental than it is just pure racism. I mean, one of the arguments we're trying to make in this book is that limited democracy serves a need for people in power, people who don't believe in an expansive state, who believe in this minimalist state. And one of the things you see throughout this period of time that we're writing about is when you have these periods of what we call emancipatory politics, in which large numbers of people can vote, particularly minorities, they support candidates who support increases in social welfare spending and spending for education and other things like this. And I think we saw that in the wake of the Civil Rights Act and the Civil Rights Movement, and particularly in the 1990s and 2000s, as we really finally break free of Jim Crow politics, more and more African Americans are able to vote and are elected to the General Assembly, and as they combine again with progressive whites, they push things like education and increased spending for healthcare and other things like that. And they also help create an expansive democracy. Where did we get same-day registration, early voting? These are all products of a period in North Carolina's history when you had this kind of biracial coalition. And I think that the conservative politics and Republican politics of the last decade really have been more directed at containing and kind of pushing back that expansive politics of the earlier period than they have been just about racism.
On the surface, I'm sorry, go ahead, Jim.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I mean, I think you can see that maybe most clearly, all that's distilled, in the history of House Bill 589, that omnibus election law reform in 2013. That law was not crafted in a vacuum. The same legislature that, created a law that the Fourth Circuit ultimately ruled targeted minority voters with laser-like precision was the same legislature, if we go down the list, that refused expansion of Medicaid, the same legislature that abolished the state's earned income tax credit, which economists across the political spectrum agree is one of the most effective ways of lifting people out of poverty. It's a legislature that made unemployment benefits in North Carolina some of the stingiest in the country. It's a legislature that on a per capita basis made severe cuts in public education. So I think, just in the history of that one piece of legislation, you can kind of see distilled all the history we're talking about here.
Since we're in a voting season and since voting in the presidential race has already begun for some people who've requested absentee ballots, let's talk about the struggles we've had here in North Carolina in recent years over voting. You have one party who seems to want to expand the right, another who wants to kind of keep it under lock and key. you have conservatives speaking ominously of voter fraud when it comes to voting by mail, and that they cast aspersions on our election system and whether or not we should trust it. On the other hand, progressives, Democrats, will say that voter fraud is rare. All signs point to them being correct about that, and they say that these calls for voter ID and other measures are attempts to shrink the electorate and disenfranchise some voters by making it more difficult for them to vote. Does a review of our history in this area show a pattern that proves one side or the other to be right, Jim?
Well, you know, this is why we turn to the history. If you go all the way back to the end of the 19th century and you look at the election law that was put in place in 1895 by a biracial black-white coalition within the Republican Party at that moment in time, it's extraordinary. We were shocked when we began to read it in detail. It's an 1895 law that required campaign finance reporting. It's a 1895 law that required employers to give workers time off to vote. It was a law that accommodated illiterate voters, about two-thirds of blacks, about a third of whites, by allowing color-coded ballots. An extraordinarily progressive election law, replaced in 1899 in the run-up to the disenfranchisement campaign with the law that overturned all of that. Well, what's striking is if you put the 1895 law against what North Carolina election law looked like before House Bill 589, the parallels are really quite remarkable.
Both of you are in the classroom with young people and at fairly prestigious universities. So we would imagine that most of these young people are pretty smart and fairly well educated, one hopes. Do they know, when you talk about this time period in our history from 1865 to the present day and how it intersected with racial attitudes and economics, et cetera, are they surprised or do they know most of this?
I think that's one of the most startling thing for me in teaching this history is just how little students know. I mean, even in North Carolina, students still don't know about, I mean, they're learning more about Wilmington and the Wilmington coup, but that's not something that's, you know, often taught in our public schools. And students are, I think, really, in many cases, very angry about this. They come and say, I mean, my Duke students say, well, we've been to the best schools in the country. We've had the best education. And all of these things that you're talking about Reconstruction, about the coup, about Jim Crow, those are things that nobody ever taught us. Why didn't we learn that? Why weren't we prepared to be citizens in the 21st century? So, and I think, you know, I think that's true for gym students at Chapel Hill as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, 82% of whom are in state and the same kind of reaction. Why don't I know this? They have the notion that Reconstruction was over in 1876. They know next to nothing about the late 19th century. Jim Crow was bad. And then we had a civil rights movement and everything was worked out.
So your book.
There's a lot missing there.
Yes, there is. I have 2 minutes left, but your book is called Fragile Democracy. And a lot of people say that the current president has all the markings of an autocrat and that he admires and would like to be like some of the world's despots. Surveys of Americans, this is even more alarming, surveys of Americans in recent years have shown that some don't value democracy and would not mind seeing a more authoritarian approach to government. If you favor democracy and American traditions, that should send shivers up your spine. So you say that history points to the need for a bold new vision of what democracy looks like. Do you have a vision of what democracy should look like? Let me ask both of you. Jim, I'll start with you.
Well, I think Bob's got a great sentence or two. He's written on this recently. Okay. But look, a democracy depends on the right to vote and the exercise of that vote. And I think this history underscores how important this is. And it also underscores how vigilant we must be. The particulars of the current moment, you know, they're in the current moment, but we've been in similar sorts of predicaments at the end of the Civil War and at the end of the 19th century. And in fact, both of those cases, we sort of stepped off the cliff. Again, people, you know, forget that in North Carolina and the South, we're talking about one party government from 1900 to 1965.
So, but before Bob, I run out of time, Bob, give me your take on that.
Well, I think that, you know, I think voting, you know, is the most consequential act a citizen can perform in a democracy. And, you know, it's a moment when we select individuals to represent us at all kinds of levels of government. And, you know, we elect them not only to pursue our interests, but the interests of the general public. And so I think one of the takeaways for us is that every time a person casts a vote, you know, this is really affirming the vitality of our democracy, and attempts to stand in the way of that or challenge our democracy. We feel pretty positive.
Bob Korstadt, about where we're going. With Duke University, James Lalutis, with the UNC Chapel Hill. Together they have written Fragile Democracy, the Struggle Over Race and Voting Rights in North Carolina. Thank you both for the hour. I appreciate it. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.